The life of a freight dog. Those pilots who flew DC-3s, Twin Beaches, and other light twins overnight, carrying packages, checks, mail, auto parts, and whatever they could fit in the planes, was sometimes dangerous. Maintenance on these planes was often subpar. Back in the days before GPS and XM and ADS-B weather, the flying could get dicey and icy. And it did for a pilot who will tell his harrowing story on this episode of I Laughed. I learned about flying from that. Hello, I'm Rob Ryder. And welcome to episode 65 of Flying Magazine's I Learned About Flying From That podcast, brought to you by Avemco Insurance. Doug Rosendahl is a highly respected pilot in the airshow and warbird communities, having flown the commemorative Air Force's iconic Redtail P-51 and C-47, That's All Brother. Today he recounts a story of incredibly fast ice accumulation when he was a freight dog, what he learned, and what he'll share with us today is invaluable. He and I will talk all about it right after this message from Avemco Aviation Insurance. Since 1961, Avemco has been the only aircraft insurance company that lets you speak directly with the decision maker, empowered to approve coverage based on your unique situation. Visit avemco.com/flying or call 800-338-8705 for a quote and save an instant 5% for being an I Learned About Flying From That listener. Save even more for most recurrent training, a new rating, or participating in Fast Team Wings. Just ask an Avemco Aviation Insurance specialist how you can qualify and how much you'll save. Now, I learned about flying from that. Doug Rosendahl is my guest on I Laughed, and you and I, Doug, have known each other a long time. And I've watched you fly a lot of different airplanes.
And I've listened to you announce a lot of air show acts.
So I don't know that we're even, but it is always a joy to work with you because of your experience. I marvel at the number of airplanes that you fly and that you are able to fly and remember the numbers for. I just focus on my airplane and I'm comfortable with it, but you seem to be comfortable with a whole lot. Tell us, Doug, how your aviation life started, because I know you've done a lot of things, but I don't know where it all came from.
So I grew up on a farm in central Iowa, and my earliest memories are sitting on a tractor, you know, driving across the field, looking up at airplanes and wondering how I get from a tractor to an airplane. My mother would tell you that my uncle came down from Minneapolis in an Aeronautica Chief and took me for a ride that I have no recollection of. I was 2 or 3 years old, and she said I never quit talking about airplanes after that. And so evidently that was the seed that was planted. But I, you know, other than that uncle who was, you know, quite a ways away, I had no other mentors in aviation or anything. And I was driving home from school the last day of finals, my freshman year in college. And I stopped at a little grass strip in Nevada, Iowa. It's gone now, but walked in the door and said, I want to learn to fly. And that was how it all started.
So it germinated from the time you were 2 or 3 years old to the time you graduated from college.
No, my freshman
year. Oh, your freshman year in college.
The summer
well, you were 19 years older.
As 18, yep. I started the summer between my freshman and sophomore year in college and ran out of money and ran out of time before the summer was over. And the next spring, I just said, I've got to get this done. And I just buckled down and went back and finished it up.
In what kind of airplanes did you train?
I tell people I got my certificate in a 150 and I learned to fly in a Twin Beach.
Okay. So from the 150, what happened between that and the Twin Beach? Because there had to have been a bunch of hours.
There was not as much as you might think. Again, I learned to fly in college. I bought a half a tri-pacer. I was paying more for half the hangar rent for my half of the Tri-Pacer than I was for my apartment in college.
But, oh, boy.
And flew the Tri-Pacer through college. And when I graduated, that was gone. And I moved to South Dakota and started working in the ag chemical industry and started working on an instrument rating. Got my instrument rating, moved to Des Moines, Iowa, and I had an uncle that had a 182RG.
Wow.
And the company that I was working for would let me fly. And so I was renting his 182RG, and I was flying around the Middle West selling herbicide and insecticide to ag chemical dealers. And built up time real quick and got up to about 700-800 hours. And I had an opportunity to buy a business with my uncle that had the 182RG. And move, and I didn't have a reason to fly anymore. I moved from Des Moines to Mason City, Iowa, Clear Lake, actually, and wasn't flying and wasn't very happy about it.
But you had a business.
But I had a business. And, I'd invested every penny I had, and it was, launching, and I was paying everybody but myself. And so times were a little sparse then. But I was driving home from work one day, and there was a DC-3 at the airport. And I slammed on the brakes, pulled into the airport, went to the airport restaurant, and met a guy named Bob Harper. And he had brought his DC-3 to Mason City, Iowa, to initiate FedEx service to our town.
In a DC-3?
In a DC-3. And so that airplane went from Des Moines or Mason City to Des Moines and Des Moines to Cedar Rapids, spent the night, and came back in the morning. And I said, I'll buy you a largest steak in these parts for riding that airplane. 6 weeks later, I was a DC-3 co-pilot.
What happened to your business?
I was flying at night, sleeping in the airplane and working in the daytime.
The DC-3 came before the Twin Beach?
Yes, I was a right seat in the DC-3, flew it for one summer. The fall came and there was no hangar at either end. There's no way you could operate a DC-3 without a hangar in the wintertime. And so they lost the contract and the local operator picked it up with half that route just from Mason City to Cedar Rapids. With a Twin Beach, and I went from the right seat of the DC-3 to the left seat of a Twin Beach with a whopping 900 hours and a VFR 135 letter, and we were scud running at night in the wintertime and hauling freight. This was the old days, the old 135.
And the old 135 didn't really draw very many lines in the sand with respect to how these airplanes were maintained.
Let's just say if the propellers turned and the flippers flipped, we went. And the joke was you never checked the mags at night because you just have to worry about it. You checked them in the morning when you got home and you could get them fixed.
Wow.
That's not entirely true, but the maintenance was subpar. The avionics were subpar. It was a brutal time and people got hurt doing that.
People died doing that.
Yeah. I was flying a Baron and fell asleep and it hit the ground and he perished. So it was, I'd be lying if I told you I hadn't fallen asleep in a Twin Beach with no autopilot. I mean, I've done that before.
What woke you up?
Huh? Oh, it's, you weren't hard asleep. You were just kind of dozing, it wasn't good, but that was kind of the standard. I mean, it was pretty common stuff. It was brutal back then.
Freight dog. What were you hauling?
Small packages for purple and brown carriers.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Then the Twin Beach got you back into DC-3s eventually, or how did you wind up flying all these warbirds that you've racked up all this time in?
Well, not only was the maintenance bad, but the weather was tough. And things like XM weather and storm scopes.
Oh, that stuff didn't exist.
Well, it might have existed, but it certainly didn't exist. I mean, XM weather didn't exist. And we had a flight service station at the airport. And you would go in there and they had this big TV looking thing. And it hooked to a 300 baud modem. And they could call up a radar picture. So immediately before you left or before you loaded your airplane, you'd run down to the flight service station and they would dial up and download a radar picture. And you'd look at this picture and you'd try to burn it in your mind. And then you go jump in the airplane and take off and try to use that to find your way.
What year was this?
This was in the, I started in 86. So this was the late 80s. And it was hard flying. And but ATC was wonderful. They knew you were in a jam and they would help you in any way they could. And, it was fun. You learned a lot.
Bet you did.
Yeah, yeah.
And the radios didn't always work well.
Well, the radios were marginal at best. You know, the Twin Beach leaked so bad that you would pull one radio out and set it on the seat to keep it dry. And if the other one got, if it was raining and the other one got wet, you'd swap radios in mid-flight to have a dry one.
But you were a single pilot.
Yeah, yeah. It was an educational time and it was hard work, but it was rewarding work and it was fun and you really learned how to fly.
You became an instructor and you have helped a lot of people to learn to fly multi-engine airplanes.
Yeah. And I was not an instructor at that time. I had really no into the instructor thing came much later when I got into Warbirds. I mean, what really I realized that, first of all, as my business got more successful, I was, you know, not dependent on the $75 a night that I was making for flying this freight run.
Oh, golly.
And I realized, you know, there were some things that happened both maintenance wise and weather wise and that I thought, you know, somebody's going to get hurt doing this. And it was entirely possible that it would be me. And I started having some opportunities in the, well, actually the guys that I'd flown the DC-3 with were CAF members in South Texas. And so in 89, I went down to visit them and I joined the CAF and I learned how the CAF worked and started moving my focus from flying freight to flying old airplanes at air shows, Warbirds. And
that were better maintained.
They were absolutely better maintained, yes. I started flying Miss Mitchell, the B-25 in the Southern Minnesota wing of the CAF in 1992, and it was a brand new airplane. And it kind of set a new standard because some of the Warbirds at that time were a little bit rugged. They were freighters with a paint job.
Oh.
But, you know, that's changed dramatically. I mean, the Warbirds that I fly today are some of the best maintained airplanes I've ever flown. I mean, they're, you know, squawk free, beautiful, new restorations in great condition. And it's really a joy and an honor to be able to fly them.
I want to do an episode with you talking about what you learned about flying from that, taking That's All Brother for the 75th anniversary right. of the D-Day invasion when you flew that across the
board. Great experience. Wonderful experience.
We'll spend an hour doing that. Let's back up now to your I laughed moment because it had to do with flying freight and it had to do with flying in the winter, which you mentioned right at the beginning of this discussion, and ice. It is the bane of everybody. But set us up the year. When was it? What kind of airplane was it? And what happened in your I laughed moment?
I can't tell you exactly what year it was, but it would have been in the late 80s or very early 90s.
Did you have GPS at that point?
No. A boat Loran was the best we had.
Gotcha.
There was an old King boat Loran that you had, and one of the airplanes we had those. But in the airplane I was flying, this had nothing. It had two navs, two comms, and a transponder. But and this particular night, I was flying a Cessna 402. The operator that I flew for had a fleet of 402s as well. And so I was in Cedar Rapids, and it was 50 degrees and raining. And
in the winter.
In the winter, well, spring, but it was 50 degrees and raining, and I was going to Fort Dodge, Iowa. The weather was messed up, so the whole schedule was messed up, and we were doing additional runs to get freight where it needed to go. And so I was going to Fort Dodge, and I looked at the weather at Fort Dodge, and it was 1,003, and ice pellets, and the wind was out of the northwest at about 30 miles an hour, and the temperature was 5 degrees above zero.
Wow.
So in
that's a recipe for disaster, isn't it?
Well, you evidently I wasn't bright enough at that time to make that connection, but it was VFR 1,003.
That's what the book says.
And so you know, I thought, well, we'll go take a look. You know, I mean, that was kind of what you did back in those days. You put the freight in the airplane and you took off and you try to figure out as you could get it closer to the destination than you were. At night, we knew where all the jets were at and we'd load the freight in the airplane. And if we couldn't get to Cedar Rapids, we went to Peoria, Illinois, or anywhere where there was a purple or a brown jet. You just got the freight to the jet. That was your job. And you might end up in a totally different town, but you were going to try to get to your intended destination. But if you couldn't get there, you'd go somewhere else. Well, in the morning, you're taking the freight the other way. And we were just trying to get it closer to where it needed to be. In this case was Fort Dodge, and that might be Mason City or whatever. But, you know, take off, go if you can make it, do it. If you can't, turn around and come back. And that was the plan. And this was probably admittedly a fairly low probability operation. So I took off, climbed up to 5,000 feet, I suppose. Well, I guess it would have been six probably because I was westbound.
But and you went through 1,003 into some clouds?
No. It was just drizzle rain, 50 degrees warm. Oh, well, so I got between layers and I'm at, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 feet warm. You know, light to medium rain, moderate rain, nothing serious, no turbulence, no convective activity, anything like that. But there's obviously a cold front coming because it's 5 degrees in Fort Dodge where I'm going. And I get to Fort Dodge and I'm on top and I can look down and I can see, you know, between layers and I can see the tops of the clouds. And there's several a long ways below me. So I surmise that this layer is not very thick. You know, once you get down that cold, there's not going to be any icing. And up on top where it's warm, there's not going to be any icing. So all I have to do is penetrate this fairly thin layer.
Define fairly thin.
It couldn't have been more than 1,000 feet based on my, and that's about what it turned out to be. So the ILS in Fort Dodge was to runway 6. The wind was out of the northwest. They have a runway 30 there. So my plan is, I'm going to go out, do the procedure turn, come inbound, pick up the glide slope, put the nose down, leave the gear up, and I'm going to come whistling down through this 1,000-foot layer.
To try to avoid picking up ice.
Right, to minimize my exposure, okay? Because I said to myself, self, there is no amount of ice you can put on a 402 descending through a 1,000-foot layer at 180 knots, so you're going down almost 1,000 feet a minute. So I'm only going to be in it for a minute. And break out. And to a downwind to 30 and land.
I mean, so it's an ILS circle to land.
Yes.
Did you, by the way, did you fly a lot of those? Because I've only flown once in all my years.
A circle to land?
Circle to land.
Oh, yeah. No, we did a lot of that.
Okay.
But we did NDB approaches too.
It's been a long time since I've done one of those.
Right. So I turned around, inbound, pick up the glide slope, push the nose down. And I'm coming down 170, 180 knots, you know, just whistling right along, coming down. And I went into the top of the clouds. And I worked construction in college. And there's this product called gunite. And basically, it is a hose with compressed air and water. And they inject concrete into that. And it makes like a stucco, concrete stucco surface. And it was like the airplane had been sprayed with gunite. Except it was ice. And instantly the windshield was totally covered, overwhelmed. We had alcohol windshield and that was, you know, anti-ice, not de-ice. And it couldn't keep up with this. And the ice started building on the wings. The airspeed indicator is unwinding like a clock. And I'm coming down the glide slope and I'm just, you know, counting the seconds to get out the bottom of this, but I can't see anything. And I start putting the power up. Add power. Now I'm at takeoff power. I've slowed. The airplane stabilizes at about 120 knots, and I break out underneath the clouds. But it's just so bad that I have to lean back just a little bit to see the tip tanks because the ice had run back so far on the windshield.
Oh, goodness.
And had I never flown a Stearman, a blind airplane, I probably would have freaked out. But I thought, you know.
Because the Stearman, because that nose is so high.
You can see nothing forward.
The whole job is peripheral vision, right. Isn't it?
And so I just said, you know, hold what you got. The circling was totally out of, I mean, here I am at full power with the gear up. And there was no opportunity to circle. So I just keep the needles crossed. and I'm going to land with a 30 knot direct crosswind. Keep the needles crossed and fly till you see something. And at about 200 feet at about minimum, so I put the gear down. And if there was a mistake, that was probably it. I probably should have landed the airplane with the gear up. Just flew it onto the runway. Because when I put the gear down, the airplane just started falling. I couldn't hold the glide slope any longer. The airplane was shaking. And, trying to stall. And I had no crosswind correction. The runway was a sheet of ice. I just, I hit and slid. And as I, I was leaning back a little bit, cheating to see something on the side, picked up the edge of the runway lights, crashed it into the runway, slid, got stopped.
Did you stop on the runway or did you go off?
No.
So you maintained directional control once you touched down, even though it was icy, or was it just dumb luck that you didn't?
No, I was leaning back, looking out the side. I mean, I could control the airplane. I still had, rudder and so forth. So I kept it on the runway and got stopped. And I opened up, it had a crew hatch. Some of the twin Cessnas had a crew hatch. So you could put freight in the back and then you could climb in the, basically the pilot's window just had hinges on it. And I opened up the crew hatch and it was like a hailstorm. These ice pellets were, probably almost like quarter inch hailstones.
That had accumulated all over the front of the airplane?
No. They weren't sticking to the airplane.
It was happening then. That was what was falling from the sky.
That was what was below the clouds.
Oh,
that wasn't sticking to the airplane. The ice was all accumulating as I came through this transition.
But down below, you were getting cold
enough. It was cold enough down below that I wasn't picking up any more ice. But I taxied to the ramp, and my legs, when I went to get out of the airplane, my legs didn't work. I mean, I was shaking so bad. I was shook. I opened the door and tried to stand, and I couldn't stand. It was probably the closest I ever come to buying the farm.
Time for a break, because I know there were some lessons learned on that. We'll be right back with more from Doug Rosendahl right after this message. Avemco insured their first plane in 1961. Ironically, that same Cessna 172 became Avemco's first claim. That's what started them on a mission to improve pilot safety. They even reward safe pilots with reduced premiums. You'll save 5% for caring enough about safety to be an I Learned About Flying from that listener. Visit avemco.com/flying or call 800-338-8705 and ask an Avemco Aviation Insurance Specialist how you can save with the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Now, back to ILAF. We're back with Doug Rosendahl, Cessna 402, excessive ice. Lots of lessons to have been learned from this, but the first question has to be, Doug, when you got out of the airplane, if you were able to stand when your knees were shaking so bad, because I'm sure you had that realization that you almost died.
Yeah. Right?
How much ice was on the airplane? Tell us about that.
So there was probably on the leading edge, there was probably 4 inches of clear ice, and it trailed back, behind the spar, trailed off. And,
and this was not a 402 that had boots.
Oh no, it had boots, but they were totally overwhelmed. I mean, the boots cannot handle that kind of ice accumulation. And, the tail was, it was a popsicle. The tail had probably 3 inches. I mean, the leading edge of the tail was just huge.
But proportionally, when you get that much ice on a smaller surface, that destroys the aerodynamics of the tail more so than the main wing, does it not?
Yeah. Well, there's one of the lessons or one of the things that I fortunately had learned prior to that was not to fool around with flaps in the ice. And, so the airplane was essentially unflyable. It was coming down the glide slope, just like a brick, and I just had enough power to drag it to the end of the runway.
What did you learn about flying from that?
Well, I learned a lot. number one, the number one rule in ice is never fly in freezing rain. Okay. I mean, it just, you know, freezing rain is a no-go item. There's zero tolerance for freezing rain. Freezing drizzle, if you see the red X's on the ADDS site, you know, just don't go. If you've got warm air above and rain falling into cold air, that's a diagnosis for disaster. But over the years of flying freight, you know, when I started flying freight, we fought ice all the time. And now I fly a lot, not hauling freight, but I fly a lot in the upper Midwest, and I've got a Baron, and I can't remember the last time I cycled the boots in anger. I just, you know, the secret to flying in ice is to fly through ice, not in ice.
Explain that.
Well, we have such incredible access to information, SKU-T charts and... And icing forecast, you know, we've got percentage of likelihood and severity, and you can go on again on the ADDS aviationweather.gov site and find the icing forecast. We know where the tops are with incredible accuracy. You were talking about going to Europe. We used a product, a website called Windy, which is an app for your phone and a website as well. And
I like it.
And we, going to Europe, we knew exactly where the ice was and, more importantly, where it wasn't. But so number one is knowing where the tops are at, and then you can formulate a plan. And, you know, you always have a plan A, and then if the plan A isn't working, you've already formulated plan B. And once you execute plan B, you better be getting to work on plan C. Because if the forecast is wrong, then all bets are off. You know, if you can't trust the data you're getting, you've got to assume, you know, that your assumptions were wrong. And so now you don't really know what you have. So always have an out, a plan B, and a third out after that. Another thing I never do is if there's ice close to the ground. Okay, if there's icing close to the ground and I'm going to shoot an approach with any possibility that I'm going to miss the approach, that for me is a no-go day. You know, I want something close above circling minimums or non-precision approach with a precision approach. So if it's a 200-foot approach, I want 600-700-foot minimums forecast and reported so that I know when I leave altitude, I'm going to finish that approach in a landing.
Personal margins, personal minimums.
Yeah.
What else?
Never let ATC fly your airplane. If you're at 5,000 or 6,000 feet in the sunshine and there's clouds from 4,000 feet to, you know, 600 feet, and there's a potential, not a potential for ice in there, and ATC says descend and maintain 3,000, unable. You know, intercept a glide slope on top of the clouds. And another trick is.
That's a good one. But that means it's way farther out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But you're.
But it doesn't make any difference. You can still intercept it.
Sure. And, you know, on a GPS approach, you know, they, you know, long ways out. But just don't let ATC get you, you know, 50 miles from the airport down in the clouds, because, you know, slogging it out is not an option. Back to what we said earlier about fly through ice, not in ice. Okay. If you're in the ice, you have to take immediate and affirmative action to exit those conditions. And the question there is, do I climb or descend?
Or 180.
Or 180. Yep. Typically my default is to climb. Unless I know definitively that there's warm air below. Because if you climb and it doesn't work and you don't get out of the ice, you can always descend. And you just pick the nearest airport and descend and land, you know, before the icing overwhelms the airplane. But if you know you've got warm air below, then descend. But exit, if you're encountering ice, fix it. And you need to visualize the ice. Okay. So if you have stratus clouds, you know, and the ceilings are 600 foot across three states, okay, that's a uniform weather mass, and there's a layer of ice, and or a layer of icing potential, and 90% of icing encounters are less than 3,000 foot vertical.
Wow.
Okay. So there are exceptions, but most of the time, especially in a cirrus situation, you know, a 3,000 foot altitude change will change the temperature enough to get you out of icing conditions. If you have cumulus clouds, now you can have icing in a vertical component because you've got rising air, you know, and you can have ice in a cumulus thunderstorm. Usually in those circumstances, you've got cumulus clouds, much higher moisture density, icing accumulates a lot faster, but usually those are towering cues and you can pick your way bobbing and weaving and pick your way as you're climbing through or descending through a cumulus layer. You can very often, broken clouds or even scattered clouds, you can stay out of the ice just by circumnavigating the clouds. And finally is along a front, you know, you can have a band of ice that, starts at the surface, and as you know, it's perpendicular. No, it's parallel with the front, but it's a band in an angle. Okay,
so yes, in that situation, you move from cold to warm.
Yes, and so in that situation, you know, if you're on the upslope side of that, you want to come to it and descend through it and get on the other side and pass. What you never want to do is parallel it, you know,
because that increases your time exposed.
Yes. And so visualize where the potential for icing can exist, you know, based on all the wonderful data we have in our pocket on our cell phone today before you ever leave the ground, and formulate a plan. And if you take that kind of approach, you're not going to end up in ice hardly ever. I fly my F1 rocket with, you know, it's got pitot heat. That's the only anti-icing protection it has. And I fly it all winter long in Iowa. And it's just not a problem. I don't, it climbs at 3,000. Climb performance is the best anti-icing protection you can have.
Of course.
You know, because my Baron climbs at 3,000 feet a minute. You know, I got a coal mill Baron, and it'll 2,500 in the wintertime. It'll make 3,000 if there's just one or two of us in it.
Wow.
And so you take off and boom, you're on top in the sunshine, and turn on the autopilot and relax. And so it's just, What I learned was how to stay out of ice, to visualize it, see where it's at, and stay out of it and never fly in freezing rain.
Good lessons from you, Doug Rosendahl. Thank you for being on I Left.
Thank you for having me.
Doug's lessons and instruction are so important. I've listened to the final segment of this episode several times to absorb what he's offered. In addition to whatever iPad app you have for aviation, it's worth checking www.aviationweather.gov/ADDS. Thanks, Doug, for your story and your teaching. Thanks to you for listening, and I hope that you'll subscribe and share it with your friends. I Laughed is available wherever you get your podcasts. We drop episodes every couple of weeks, so you can hear the firsthand accounts of the flying lessons that sometimes only experience can teach. Lisa DeFries is the executive producer of I Laughed, and Julie Boatman is editor-in-chief of Flying Magazine. For Avemco Aviation Insurance and Flying Magazine, fueling the passion for flight since 1927, I'm Rob Ryder. Catch you next time on I Learned About Flying From That.